Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Italy spoils all the fun. Consumer confidence at a five-month high, and Green Mountain Coffee shares get toasted. All this and a lot more on episode number 238 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast for November 13th, 2011. Well, hi there, this is Andrew Horowitz, and we have a lot more to talk about. We have some great guests today. We have two, in fact. We have Sajid Das, who wrote the book Extreme Money, and by popular demand, because I'm always getting emails to have Das come on. He's going to be on today, as well as Tom McClellan. You know the McClellan Oscillator and all the good things that he writes about markets. We'll dig into some ways to find out just what is the market direction and pick his brain a little bit about what's going on. I have a lot of questions to ask him in terms of, you know, this the volatility and the movement. Are we in an uptrend, a downtrend? I mean, what is he saying? So we'll get to that in a minute. I have a few things I want to talk about, and then I know we're going to spend much more time with the guest today because we do have two. But I want to talk about Italy first and mention that, obviously, over the weekend there was this maybe a changing of the guard where the prime minister will be stepping down, and that's being forced upon him because the rest of the party, and the opposition party in particular, is going to try to pass some type of budget referendum. Why they couldn't do this before, I have no idea. Why are they waiting until the last minute? Well, that's kind of simple. Because they can. They know that the longer they wait, the more the problems will erupt inside the market. And the more problems you have, the more likely it is that there's going to be panic. And that panic is going to allow them to get more money in a much quicker time frame without the oversight and without meeting their objectives. That's as I see it. Same thing happened with Greece, and probably going to see the same thing with a few other countries. Greece clearly is not going to meet their budget needs and demands of the ECB and the euro and the bailout package, but they'll get their money, $100 billion or so. And even with all the shenanigans they're pulling, they're going to get their money. So, you know, it doesn't really matter, it seems. At all costs, Germany and France are trying to keep this whole thing together, and that's good for everybody. But we'll see how it goes. Interestingly enough, consumer confidence hit a five-month high. University of Michigan put out their number on Friday, and the expectations really grew pretty substantially, but it really was from a very, very low base. The bottom line on this, you have to remember, is that when the stock market goes up, everybody's happy. And that really seemed to be the sole factor that probably pushed consumer confidence up for the month. But the good news is the market read-through on that is that when consumers are happy, because maybe the market is happy, well, then consumer discretionary stocks and other stocks may do well. So you have to look at that in a positive light. Whether or not you're positive and happy in terms of the economic conditions and outlook, whether or not you think that there's going to be a collapse or a major growth that is coming around the corner, bottom line, we have to follow the trend of what is happening now. And we'll get to that a little bit later with Tom McClellan. Everything that we're seeing, though, points to, as interestingly as it may be, is to a continuing of an uptrend. We have about 3-4% move lower in a combined index that we put together. We call it our market trend indicator. That would cause us to say, well, this is really getting a little bit sloppy here, and we really need to take our foot off the pedal. But right now, we're seeing that even with any of these drops, the buy the dip mentality is there. So we just got to go with that. Also, Green Mountain Coffee's last week. Now, this is interesting because the coffee company has been a rock star when it comes to just beating earnings and making money hand over fist. And they didn't really impress last week. As a matter of fact, a few weeks ago, one of the big hedge fund names that comes out very vocally to support or move against a particular company came out. I think it was Einhorn. It was Ackerman or Einhorn. I think it was Einhorn. And he came out and said, you know, this is really a problem. We're shorting this, et cetera. Stock comes down a bit. Lo and behold, earnings comes out, and there was a lot of concern in there. Stock drops 40% in one day. Talk about a crazy move. You know, we've tried to actually get in there and short a few times, but you get blown out because the love affair with these companies are just remarkable. Priceline is an example. We had a short position on it last week, very, very small position on it into earnings. And they came out, and not only did they disappointed pretty significantly, in my opinion. And you know what happened? Stock went up 8%. I mean, it's funny because it all depends on what the sentiment is surrounding the stock, whether the earnings are going to come in at this level or that level, where they beat, where they look like they were going to come in, the whisper numbers, all this combined into going into what the projection is going to be and what the read-through with the market's going to be. But nonetheless, it all depends on, again, the love affair with a particular stock. And sometimes they last for a long time, even when things aren't looking good. And then when all of a sudden everybody realizes, well, that's maybe not the stock I should be loving anymore, we get a Green Mountain Coffee situation. You know, same thing happened with Netflix recently. But anyway, we'll talk about that in upcoming weeks. We're going to get to our guests in a moment. Before we do, I want to make sure that you know a couple different things. Number one, that this show, this episode is sponsored by, you know them, GoToMeeting.com. Wonderful, wonderful service. What's really cool about that is I'm noticing a lot of different social networking sites and a lot of different places are really starting to embed this kind of program and this kind of process into their everyday, because it's so popular the way that this is being used and for different things than just meetings, maybe, you know, doing things like sharing photos or possibly even just collaborating on homework. This is more than just meetings out there. So if you're a personal user of a computer and you're not in a business, you think, well, wow, is this something that I can use? Sure, absolutely. You know, I do a screen sharing session with my son for homework, and we go over the books, we go over the things that he's doing in class, his notes, etc. And it's really easy to teach that way and to really collaborate. So you can get your free trial of this for 30 days. Go to gotomeeting.com and put in the promo code podcast at gotomeeting.com, and you'll get a free 30 days. Really great service. Before we get to our guest, first up is Das, by the way, and again, the author of Extreme Money. We'll have all the information on how to contact our guests, as we always do, and to get more information at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you should go there to find out where to get the book, or you know, you can find out past guests, or you can find out what we're writing about, stocks that we're, you know, talking about. We quite often talk about a stock here or there, economics. We talk about, it's more than here and there. We do it constantly. We do a lot of writing, so it's just not just a podcast here. It's also an information source that we spill through to you as well. So make sure to do that. If you're interested in investing in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, all you have to do is go there also. You can see a 14-minute little quick virtual tour, and you can find out more about how we do it, why we do it, where we do it, what it's all about, and it's a minimum investment of $50,000. And, you know, if you haven't been able to really get yourself to figure out, well, which direction do I want to move? Well, we go both sides. We go short, we go long, we use options, we trade, we buy and hold. We do all sorts of things there because different economic conditions, different market conditions demand that you have a different strategy. So go check that out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And let's get to our guests, because I know I'm dying to talk to Das and Tom, and we'll find out more about that, because these are people you need to listen to when it comes to what they say. It matters, and it really counts. It's more than just the blatherings you hear on a lot of media out there. These smart guys. It's my good friend Das, who all the way from Australia, who was recently telling me about a band that sang a song called "You Gotta Believe It." I thought, silly me, that there was only one band from Australia, and I guess I was wrong about that. So, hey, Das, what's going on? How's it doing down under?
Well, it's summer, and you're going into winter, yeah, so it can't be all bad.
Yeah, right. It's the summer of discontent is what it is.
Oh, there's a Rolling Stones song, Street Fighting Man. There's summer, and they'll be marching in the streets. That's probably the song for the year. Certainly in Europe, it's winter, but they're still marching in the streets.
Right, there is a lot of confusion, I think, and you and I have talked about this for the last, it's got to be a year now, about what are going to be the ramifications in Europe and how is that going to play out. And I think one of the biggest issues that we have to look at right now is how great globalization was to the United States and developed countries in, well, let's say the last 20 years, and how the reality now is that globalization can turn around and bite you in the butt really hard because of the interconnectivity of all the finances and of all of the transportation, the exports, imports. And we're really seeing that right now, and that's what's happening with Europe, right?
I think you're absolutely correct. I think when you have a very linked system of any kind, you're assuming that every bit works and every bit's on the same standard. I'll give you a very good example of that. If you have an electricity grid, you're assuming the voltages and all the little bits and pieces which move the electrons around are the same. The problem is in economic globalization, you have systems which are completely different, which are linked. And the other problem is the people running those systems have entirely different ideas of A, how the system should operate, and B, how the system actually works. And finally, the amount of ability they have to actually run the system varies enormously. And once you link them together, it becomes hugely vulnerable. And I think, you know, as an American friend of mine said to me, he didn't understand anything about Greece. He said, Greece is smaller than Minnesota, which ironically, by the way, where the ex-prime minister of Greece, George Papandreou, was born. He actually was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, I think. And I said to him, look, think about it this way. How much does the United States export to Europe? It's about $400 billion, which is about 20% of your exports. You then send stuff to Asia, which is repackaged and put into other goods, sent to Europe. Then your banks have exposure, a la, you know, all the major banks, but people like MF Global, it now turns, has an exposure of $100 billion or so to the actual European sovereign debt. So that's the problem. And then you don't know how much hidden exposure you have through, you have exposure to French banks, or you have exposure to English banks, who all have exposure to Europe. And then finally, the savings, the pension savings in the United States, under the wonderful theory of diversification, some portion of that goes outside the United States, and some portion of that goes to Europe. You are actually much more implicated in this. And this guy looks at me and says, you mean my pension plans are dependent on Greece, Italy, Spain? I'm going, not entirely, but probably more than you think.
Right, because you have also world sentiment. You have the reality that banks have are touched with this, and the global unrest because of all this. It really is a very linked situation. But in terms of Greece, you know, I don't think that there was an understanding, you know, how much there really is this this knock-on effect when you have a sovereign nation who basically can just issue bonds and keep on, you know, keep on keeping on. And then the problem with Europeans seem to be that they don't want to really give up their own independence. And then on top of that, you have a government that I don't even know what's going on in Greece, because, you know, what they did last week with, you know, the new election of another prime minister falls through. I mean, I don't understand it, that why they're not getting this, except for the fact that they know no matter what happens, they're getting their $100 billion.
Look, I think fundamentally the Greek politics, the issues around Silvio Berlusconi, and people forget there's political problems aplenty elsewhere. I'll give you two examples which nobody talks about. One is in Spain. They have an election coming up which is between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Mm. And there's a wonderful cartoon in Spain where somebody watches the debate between these two people, and the guy says, I wonder who will be running Spain after the election. And his wife says, it doesn't matter among those two. It's going to be Angela Merkel.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, so there's all this elections going on, but crucially in Netherlands and Germany, in Netherlands, the coalition, believe it or not, the government relies on the opposition to vote with them to pass European bailout legislation. And the opposition have said they're sick of it because nothing is going to solve this problem. And why should they put their political capital into this equation? And in Germany, there's this wonderful guy called Franz Schäffler, who's a member of the FDP, which is in coalition with Angela Merkel's CDU. And he is a fairly astute. He's not an important politician, but what he's actually done is he's used the FDP constitution very carefully. What he's done is he's got this referendum where the FDP are going to vote because their individual members have the right to determine party policy. And they're going to vote about whether they want to support the bailout packages. And he's got enough votes. Between now and December, he'll have enough votes to basically withdraw the FDP potentially from this coalition, which will almost certainly create a huge problem for Angela Merkel and may ultimately bring down a government. So the politics is an entire mess. But the reality is, you could change the leaders. He could change the government. But it's like changing, effectively, the captain of the Titanic after he's rammed the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problems that they're all going to confront is exactly the same. And the Europeans have wasted 2 years prevaricating, pretending that the problem doesn't exist, and then coming up with these astonishingly half-baked solutions. I mean, the crucial thing that people did not focus on the 27th of October announcement of, you know, yet another grand comprehensive plan which was going to fix everything, was the whole crucial thing was no European country, especially Germany and France, were going to put one more euro into saving these countries. And the whole thing was, it was like almost like a surreal fantasy. We aren't going to put any more money in. You know, everything will be fine. And, you know, this magic thing called the bailout fund, the European Financial Stability Facility, will somehow come up with all this money with sort of a little bit of, you know, we'll put a bit of Chinese money and a bit of Indian money in, and we'll stir it around and we'll borrow it from the IMF. And somehow, miraculously, it'll work. Now, I mean, these guys, and I just don't get why markets believe these guys actually have a solution, simply because they haven't got a solution. I mean, you and I both know the answer. The answer is people have made bad loans. They're going to have to write it off. There's going to be a massive wealth loss, and it's going to take us a decade, maybe more, to work our way through that.
Wait. Just this week, I think it was Stark said it's only going to take 1 to 2 years, and the market had, in the U.S., had a miraculous 1.5% turnaround. And I said, let me get this straight. Stark said that it's going to take 1 to 2 years. That's what was blamed on this big market run-up earlier in the week. And, you know, wouldn't it be, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't it be nice if somebody could give me a little bit of backup data on this besides just coming out of his ass?
There's no way it's going to take 1 to 2 years.
But how does he say this and people believe it without any kind of data, without, this could have been a discussion at a lunchtime speech that there's nothing backing it up, there's no projections, and everybody just takes this crap as face value. And I blame the press for this, by the way.
I think there's absolutely no doubt. I mean, and you can blame two groups of people. One is, it's very clear to me that the politicians and the policymakers, because they've run out of options, really, they have no more options. They're not trying to do a confidence game. And as I said, the one thing about the recent plan was they got the con part right. It was the rest of the word confidence that was missing.
Right.
And the next thing is the press. And essentially, I find the reporting these days of financial matters to be fairly variable. There are good writers, but on the whole, the level of qualification of these people, I don't know what they are, but they don't really actually get whatever it is that they need to get. But most importantly, they're unquestioning. They report this stuff, which is really Stark's opinion, and effectively as kind of a fact, Europe will recover in 1 to 2 years. And I'm sitting there going, no. And by the way, that contrasts hugely with Angela Merkel, who about the same time came back from the G20 grumbling that nobody was going to give Europe any money, and also grumbling that that the whole problem would go on for a very long time, and C, the fact that Europe probably should never have led Greece into the euro. I mean, it was quite surreal to think that all of these problems can be solved in 1 to 2 years.
Well, then you have also that right after the Stark announcement, I think a day later, the IMF came out and said that there's a, you know, significant risk to the, you know, but then again, this whole thing goes back and forth. On one day, there's a lot of risk, markets sell off. The other day, somebody says, hey, things are much better, and the markets move up. It's a very, very stressful situation for investors. My listeners are, you know, getting like to a point that they're wondering, you know, what really is going on around here? Because, you know, you're right. The reporting is pretty awful. There is no questioning. I constantly am writing writers and saying, why don't you stop with this anonymous crap and this unnamed source? I think it's a terrible, yeah, terrible practice. And all they're doing really is using you to test out ideas on the market.
Exactly.
And exactly. So that's a problem. And then finally, I think the biggest issue is that when we look at all of this and try to put our heads around all this, you know, you have to believe somebody. So do we believe, or you could be that curmudgeonly guy and say, I don't believe anybody. But then where does that get you? You know, you have to believe something. So do we believe Bernanke and all that? I don't know. Do we believe? Listen.
Well, actually, I got accused the other day of being a destructionist.
Oh.
And I said, I'm not familiar. Is that a religion or is it a political party? And he said, no, you just want the world to be destroyed. I said, frankly, if I wanted the world to be destroyed, I'd just basically sit here and do nothing, say nothing, because it's doing a pretty good job on its own.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm saying these things is I'm trying to get people to actually think about some of these things. I'm not saying I have any answers, because there are probably very limited options, and some may work, some may not work. But people have to think about it. But, you know, you have to go back. In my view, you have to go back, and in particularly in periods of stress, simplify it down. The first thing is, if you actually look at Europe, just let's look at the hard numbers. Even with the plan, Greece's debt to GDP is going to be 120% in 2021.
That was their goal.
And I'm saying, sorry, this is going to save them, is it?
Right,
this is going to save them.
Right.
And then you listen to the lies, like, oh, we've cut 50%. And you say, yeah, but you've cut 50% of the $200 billion, which is owed to banks. By the way, of that $200 billion, 85 is owed to Greek banks and Greek pension funds. So let's reduce that down to 115 to external lenders. We're cutting 57.5 billion euros, which by any stretch of the imagination is a sizable sum of money, but it's 15% of the total debt burden.
And by the way, how that didn't trigger CDS.
I have no idea. Manipulated.
Right.
But you know, it's even funnier, Andrew, because the reason we only cut the 50% off the 60% of the 200 million was the European Central Bank, which owns about 80 billion of Greek bonds. If there'd been a 50% write-off, they've got 5 billion in capital. They'd be bankrupt.
Mm.
So that's why it was done. So people have to look through to the facts and see what those facts mean. Like the 106 billion that the banks have to raise in capital. I mean, it's just ludicrous. Number one, that's only covering Greece. What about Ireland? What about Portugal? What about Spain and Italy, which is obviously now hugely problematic? And also, what about the second-order effects? If all these countries have problems, what's growth going to look like? What are the second-order effects on the normal cyclical bad debts of the banks? And then you have the person doing this forecast is the European Banking Authority, the EBA, which, by the way, was the same people who said in July this year that the entire European banking system needed 2.5 billion euros in capital. And Dexia, which is now bankrupt pretty much, was actually in the top 10 of best capitalized banks in Europe.
Yeah, we put that out there. That was an unbelievable. They had the cleanest balance. They had the best capital, tier one capital ratios, and they were highly recommended. And that was only a few months ago, and really quite astonishing. What was being hidden by Dexia that they couldn't find, or what they're not seeing. But then again, it's again the same thing. It's a combination, I think. You said, well, what, you know, if I don't say anything, and, you know, am I a destructionist if I talk about this stuff? You know, I think the truth is that this whole confidence game is what is the glue that holds together economies. I really do.
Oh, I agree with you. And one of the things that I'm now starting to think is what the end game is, not only in an economic sense or a financial sense, but a social and political sense. And I think if you actually look at this, and you look at what happened in the 1920s, is there was a complete breakdown in trust. And, you know, our societies are basically held together with a glue, and that confidence you're talking about is part of a fabric of trust, that we believe the data, we believe people are telling the truth, and we believe they have the best interests of everybody at heart. And I can point to sort of four or five things now where there's a complete breakdown in trust. One, I mean, the answer to everything is how to print money. I mean, money has to have some value, particularly paper money. And people have to believe in it. Now, if everybody's just going to turn the printing presses on and just keep printing money, it's not going to fix the problem. We know that. But it's going to undermine the value of money. And you can see this. I mean, you can see this in the gold price going up. And putting money into gold, well, I can understand why people do it, isn't terribly productive. You know, other than a few gold miners around the world who dig the stuff out of the ground.
Yeah, you know what? And I think what you're describing is a cruise with unlimited alcohol and just you going to the bar constantly and then realizing at the end that somebody's got to pay for this.
Absolutely. And then you undermine government bonds. I mean, if you want to really undermine the financial system, once you actually lose the concept of one truly safe, secure asset, I mean, everything else becomes impossible.
Right.
I mean, that's what they're doing. Then, of course, you look at the institutions. I mean, in the United States, you have at this moment this huge trend away from major banks to credit unions and so forth, which was started by the woman over the Bank of America debit card fees. But that shows just the complete lack of belief in these institutions. I mean, you know, the banks in the United States used to be Jimmy Stewart.
Yep.
And It's a Wonderful Life.
Yep.
At the moment, I tell you what, it would be Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Hanging.
Yeah, no, so there is no, every once in a while we'll invest a little bit in the banks. I mean, short term. When I say short term, I mean short term. You know, like very couple of days kind of thing. But generally speaking, they scare the bejesus out of me. And the truth of the matter is that I don't understand, back to Europe, for example, how that's, you know, all being played out. Asia's a little bit tougher to figure out because their data is a little bit more, I guess. Yeah. And around the world, otherwise, it's kind of like questionable. And, you know, I don't never recommend, and haven't in years, getting anything near a bank or Latin America bank, because, you know, once you have a situation where you take bold action to devalue, it becomes easier in the future.
Absolutely. And I think this is a breakdown of trust. And you look at, and what we've been talking about is a breakdown in fundamental things like, A, the systems we have, the policy options we have clearly been shown to be inadequate. And also the institutions, the politicians we were talking about, just the faith in these people. And they're turning out to be, A, I mean, people can make mistakes. I can understand people in very difficult circumstances making mistakes. None of us are perfect. None of us know everything. But the point is, they're now blatantly not telling anybody the truth. They're pretending there are no problems when there are problems. And also, what is really, to my mind, the most egregious part of it is they have to be honest with their populations, with their voters, and say, look, it's going to be difficult. I mean, I was in a program very recently about Greece, and there were a lot of Greeks on this program, Greek Australians and also Greeks in Greece. And the fundamental thing that they were saying is, look, we are willing to take pain. We're willing to do what's necessary. They're a proud people with a tremendously long history. But, you know, what we see is people just essentially, the politicians and the bankers, looting us and expecting us to suffer 50, 60% losses of income in perpetuity. And we're not going to take it.
Yeah.
No, and it's going to be like that famous line from, I think it's the Peter Finch movie, Network. You know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I talked about that last week on a podcast, and somebody, I said that was from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and they yelled at me that I got the wrong movie. I'm like, I did? That's funny that you mentioned that. Listen, let's kind of get on to a couple of different things. Number one, I think that there is a fine line between, you know, hell and damnation and going down the tubes and everything goes suffers, which is kind of like the good day or bad day. It's a very manic market in the U.S. and around the world. You know, you go to sleep, and then you know, with one set of information points, right? And you wake up truly a few hours later, like, what happened? What changed? Where did everything go? And I think that there is something to be said, though, about there is the potential for good companies to still do well. That doesn't mean the stock is necessarily going to do well, but the companies may do well. You know, there's still mouths to feed. There's places to go. There's clothes to buy. There's houses to build. There is a situation where, you know, the economies still move on around the world. And even with, you know, a lot of the slowdown, there's still a lot of need. But that problem is that at the end of the day, and I wrote an article about this week, is, you know, if I hear one more person talk about the market is cheap due to P.E. ratio, I'm going to kill them. Because using P.E. ratio is the stupidest formula to measure what the market's value is in terms of cheapness or expensive, because what you're looking at is one number over history. And the problem is that P.E. ratio is not a simple – when you talk about it that way, you can't talk about it simply by, okay, price, earnings, that's it. No. You need to take out sentiment. You need to look at – future projection and growth. You need to look at interest rates and all that. Now, when you do that and you want to talk about it in a formula and say, well, PEs are cheap because whatever, fine. But if just to say PEs are cheap, this is what I'm telling everybody. When you hear that the next time in media, you hear that on or read that anywhere, everything that comes after that sentence, disregard.
Well, can I join you in the pitchfork battle against the people who say that? Because I hate it as well.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you. I think people can get too negative here.
Yep.
And I think there's two issues here. One is the world's not going to end, okay? The world's going to enter.
I feel better. Oh, my God. Thank you.
Exactly. The world's not going to end. But we're going to enter a period of low growth, of stagnation. And people forget that during the 1920s and 1930s, which were extremely difficult economic times, money was still made. People did make money.
Right.
But you've got to think about it differently. And I think I've spread out two sort of time horizons. One is a kind of a medium time horizon, and the other is a short-term volatility, and particularly the risk of a catastrophic error. Because I think the biggest factor in the market is now it's driven by policy announcements, which are completely incomprehensible to me, simply because nobody seems to know anything about what they're doing, and they keep changing their minds from day to, one day to the next. And I think there is a chance, it's not a zero chance anyway, of a major policy miscalculation, which leads to, you know, a fairly disruptive event. But in the medium term, let's go back to exactly the point that you made. Companies are going to make money. And I think you've got to look at companies which are in industries which will do well. And frankly, what I now look for is very simple, long, stable cash flows. Mm-hmm. I forget about whether if I buy at 100, I'm going to get back 120. I'm more interested in, okay, I buy 100, I'm buying a perpetual stream of dividends.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how vulnerable are those dividends? What's the rate of return on those dividends? That's the first thing I focus on. Because fundamentally, those companies which are well-positioned, which have cut their costs, which are in the right market spaces, will do okay. They won't do fantastically. But if you're looking for a buy and flick, that's more difficult. But if you're doing the buy and flick, other than inside information, which which is handy, but right. Not legal.
Thanks, Raj.
That's right. And actually, to be honest, Raj is not mine. It's not anywhere in my name. I want to assure everybody.
No, I know.
And I'm
kidding.
From India, and I'm not from Sri Lanka,
right,
and
right.
I have no idea, and I don't belong to any expert network. Any other pieces of evidence, I'll give you my mother's birth certificate.
Oh, wow, thanks.
But coming back, but the other thing is, all these companies are building up cash. People say you don't understand how a corporate balance sheet works. If you don't get top-line growth, which they're not getting, revenue's not growing, they don't invest, their working capital releases, they get a huge buildup of cash, which they're going to release. And you're going to get one-off special dividends, share buybacks, which is good for you. But the other thing is that they're going to start to buy other companies and
yep.
so forth. There's going to be a lot of M&A activity, some of it good, some of it not so good. But you can take advantage of that to basically, if you position yourself correctly, to do quite well out of it, because the industries are going to consolidate. So you need to trap that income, because essentially, let's be honest, and your relativity point is very well made, interest rates are going to be very low for prolonged periods of history. I'll tell you the worst financial decision I ever made. A friend of mine runs a JGB fund, a Japanese government bond fund. Around about 96, I think it was, he said to me, you know, JGBs are 3%. Is that good or bad? I said, you know, 3% for 20 years, that doesn't seem the right sort of risk-reward ratio.
Oh, boy.
And in oh yeah, and was I wrong? I mean,
well, you could that was impossible to predict that it's going to get to this level.
Absolutely,
I mean, but it's ridiculous.
But what it shows you, the lesson I learned from that is looking at the past, looking at normal metrics, sometimes in abnormal times, is dangerous.
Yep.
And I think we know that Bernanke is going to keep interest rates down. The long end of the curve is also going to stay down because there's no inflation, no matter what anybody tells me.
Right.
If you strip food and energy out of it,
yep.
there's no inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, under those circumstances, the big game is going to be to look for return in terms of yield. And you can buy, obviously, shares with good dividend yields, but you'll also be able to pick up good corporates with good cash flows who can basically pay back that debt at reasonable returns.
Right.
So there is going to be money to be made. And this is for particular people. And most people can't trade every day of their lives and every move.
It's that's what they got me for.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the next issue is that they've got to try to get some benefits out of the volatility. And sometimes strategies which capture the volatility, particularly wild swings, by buying options and so forth, might also work for you.
Yeah.
But those are the only things that you can really do. I mean, I'll give you one picture last night. I was sitting here actually watching some stuff. And the most amusing thing about that was the BTPs, which are the Italian government bonds, were spiking at the rate of 1 basis point a minute.
Yeah, well, that happened throughout the week. I mean, it was crazy what was going on. Crazy.
Oh, it was absolutely unbelievable. It was absolutely unbelievable. And I was watching there going, this is just basically surreal in the best way I can describe it. And I said, how the hell do you trade this?
Well, let me ask you a question. Let me ask a question. Let's set this up. First of all, let's put in the backdrop of all this, that there's been discussion by many economists all over TV and media that if the rate of Italian bonds goes above 7%, that is going to be catastrophic, right? Let's put that in the background.
Yep.
And now you have an Italian bond auction, and let's pretend I'm Italy for a second, and you're a buyer. And I say, here's the deal. The deal is that right now we're having some difficulty. You know, right now we have probably the fourth largest debt in the world, and we have a debt-to-GDP problem, and we have a problem with the collection of taxes. On top of that, high unemployment and slow growth and all that. Now, on top of that, I just want to mention to you that we're really not sure about our government structure at this point. We are in between in flux of possibly our leader stepping down if we can confirm a budget that we're not exactly sure if it's going to work. Now, how many bonds do you want to buy?
Oh, I think the only buyers of Italian BTPs is going to be basically the Italian banks,
right,
who will then take the bonds, go to the European Central Bank, and repo them to fund them.
Right.
And the only other buyers will be other Central European central banks.
Right. And then as a backdrop, you have that you know that, you know, the bond vigilantes are gunning for that 7%. So they get it there. So they get it there. And then on top of that, I don't know why, really, I don't know why, the ECB didn't step in to really artificially behind the scenes push this stuff down, because they're just stupid. You know, I understand it's manipulation, I understand all that, but they're just stupid. Because the fact of the matter is, by not doing the things that are required, I don't mean that by that should be manipulation, but we know that they have the money to basically be buying some sovereigns. And you know what? Even not if that's not the case, you could step in and buy some of them, and you're gonna, at the end of the day, it's all the same money right now anyway.
To some extent, you're right. But the real issue is, I think the ECB is really conflicted, because the ECB's problem effectively is that they are now almost the de facto government of Europe, because essentially the government mechanism doesn't work. And if you look at the three options that are on the table for doing anything in Europe, one is obviously Germany just assumes all this debt, and Germany and France, but they can't afford to do that. The second is they allow destructive defaults, which nobody wants to see, because it would bring down the euro. And the third one is printing money. But the problem is the ECB, by its charter, can't print money. And also the Germans are essentially committed not to allow the ECB to print money.
Yeah, because they're the ones that got the benefit all these years, but in the end, they're going to get the biggest screwing.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing here, which is quite amusing, is that the Germans themselves don't get it. I was in Europe about a month ago and talking to Germans. They don't actually seem to think that there's a problem, because effectively they are doing quite well. So basically on a personal level, they go, well, what's the problem? And then you point out to them this, and they go, oh, well, nobody's told us. And then I watched a clip of the actual parliamentary debate in Germany about the passing of the expansion of the European Financial Stability Fund. The debate was hilarious, because nobody was allowed to speak against the motion. Angela Merkel couldn't bring herself to speak in favor of the motion. But the funniest bit was when two of the parliamentarians who voted for this package were interviewed by a German television crew outside. And they asked them what they passed. They had no idea. Who was it for? They had no idea. And then the crucial question was, well, how much money did you commit? They said, oh, €1 billion, something like that. It was €211 billion.
Yeah.
They had no idea.
Yeah.
They had no idea what they'd passed.
It's astonishing.
To think this is all going well.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. I want to kind of segue, because we really haven't talked about this. I don't think we've talked about this on the show, but the whole MF Global situation. Now, let me just give everybody a little bit of a setup here. So MF Global was a 200-year-old company that has some roots in you know, some very strong futures and options and plays. And in fact, just to kind of bring you full circle here or up to date, in 2009, I was questioning whether this place was going to stay in business. And former governor of New Jersey, former senator, former CEO of Goldman Sachs, John Corzine, comes to the rescue and says, I will be the CEO and all that. And he comes in and everybody's, oh, this is wonderful. Now, meanwhile, my history lesson of John Corzine goes back to when he made big bets on things over at Goldman and was very stubborn and wouldn't break his bets, no matter really what the level of losses were in the interim. There was a time, I think, that he had 100 or 200 million at the time, it was big, $1 million loss, and the partners were just getting whacked left and right, and bonuses were getting whacked left and right, and he ended up coming out with a little bit of a gain, but I think there was another one that he lost over $100 million. So this is the history of this gent. comes to MF Global and does his thing and makes an investment utilizing the funds of the firm. For a moment, I have no idea if he commingled and he used other money. So let's just say he used the funds of the firm, leveraged them about 30 times, and bought, of all things, the sovereign debt of Italy and Spain and Portugal and Ireland. It didn't say Greece anywhere that I saw. But okay. What is this guy thinking?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here which are fascinating. The one is just straying outside your own business competence, because MF Global, I remember them as well, because I remember them as an institutional broker of futures and options and a few other things, and they were quite competent. There was nothing wrong with them. Mm-hmm. They did that. What were they doing, thinking they could become a full-fledged investment bank and basically go and bet with shareholders' capital? That's the most interesting thing. And how the board sanctioned that, I have no idea.
Well, it's very simple. It's Corazon convinced him. Listen, this guy had a big ego. He had bonds on him. Well, it wasn't even bonds. It was an option that he created to pay off. The upside call would be, if he got appointed to a presidential position of maybe economics or some other position inside the White House, that would be the option would pay off. Did you know that?
Yes, I was aware of that.
What an
ass.
As you say,
yeah, but how anybody can agree to that, it's beyond my capacity to appreciate. But then the next issue is, I think Corazon, whatever his competences and so forth, or incompetences for that matter, but the crucial thing is, he's not alone, because there is this blind faith that A, government bonds are secure, B, the Europeans are going to come in riding in on a white charger to save Italy and so forth. And I've been saying to people that when market paradigms change, when regimes shift, the one person you do not want to have making a decision is somebody who has history. It can be very dangerous because they didn't learn
right.
the facts.
During the downslope.
Absolutely. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, during the upslope, it's great because they know what happened afterwards. And if it actually goes that direction, you're a hero.
Absolutely. And this goes to your points about P.E. ratios and so forth. You know, looking at the past is interesting sometimes, but it doesn't necessarily give you very good clues.
Right.
And I think the crucial thing here is, if you just, again, go back to the facts and do the numbers, these countries overall, if Germany was to take them over, is basically going to need about 200 billion euros a year. Now, let's assume for the moment, let's see France out of it, because France has its own problems. You look at Germany. If you take 200 billion every year out of the German budget, remember, the German GDP is about 3 trillion. So you're taking about roughly, say, 7-8% of GDP and channeling it to these countries. By the way, that's about roughly 20% of annual tax revenues in Germany. So basically, you're asking the taxpayers to say, you put €100 in tax to the government, and 20 euros of that will go to your southern neighbors in the interest of saving the euro. And you sort of say that might work, provided you don't tell them about it. But it's not going to work if you tell them about it. And Corazon's bet, really, in the end, was number one, that this is economically feasible. But then it was extremely politically naive. I mean, the signs have been clear for the last 6 to 12 months that the Germans are being sort of dragged inch by inch to do something. And I think at the point, they've reached the point where they're saying, well, I don't think this is going to work. And not only that, the other countries like Finland, Netherlands, and so forth have already reached that point. And France has a different problem. I mean, France, I think, is on the verge of being downgraded.
Well, you and I have talked about this. I think we've talked about it offline.
Yeah.
That's my greatest fear.
I think they're on the verge.
And I think the problem is, and they were recently said that they're going to be good, but now the problem is that when you combine the three blind mice, five blind mice, or the entire army of blind mice running around Greece and Italy right now, and not to mention other places, I think that the problem is that now that there is no real plan, that it seems, and there is no effective government in Italy.
Andrew, you're very harsh. There is a plan. There is a plan to have a plan.
Oh, but they're not going to tell us? They're not going to tell us?
No. There's a plan to have a plan, and the plan to have a plan is to have another meeting, to have another plan, and then to have a summit. And, you know, basically, we're just going to go on.
These guys must have the best life.
They have the best number of frequent flyer miles.
And they have great meals and all that, and they just get it wrong, and they plan.
Andrew, have you ever wondered, if you fly on presidential jets and, you know, chancellors, private jets, do you think they get frequent flyer miles?
Yes, on all the airlines, actually, at the same time.
Absolutely. So there must be great, you know, you must be able to, I mean, Angela Merkel's just practicing for her holidays and for retirement when she gets booted out.
You know, actually, though, what's really kind of interesting is, you know, last batch of meetings over in Europe, they pretty much narrowed it down to a day and a half, maybe, of meetings to solve all the problems. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And I'm thinking, let me, like, sometimes it takes me a day and a half to figure out how to, I don't know, you know, what to wear. And meanwhile, they're going to solve all the problems of their entire region. Anyway, crazy stuff. Let's just kind of, we could go on and on for hours about this. Your book, I know it's getting great reviews. I've seen you recently in the Financial Times. There was a video of you there, of course, in the Inside Job. Was you played the starring role of the handsome gentleman who obviously got all the women. You've written a book. Tell us about the book. How's it doing?
The book's doing okay. It's sold reasonably well in most parts of the world. It's up to about, I think, 22,000 copies sold globally, which for what is not Jamie Oliver's cookbook is probably quite respectable.
Right.
And look, it's one of those things. I think I wanted to do it. I wanted to put some information out there to people who are interested, wanted to do it. Now, whether they like it, whether they buy it and read it, that's their decision. You can never control it. You can't control that part of the process. But I'm very gratified by the fact that most of the reception
that's
received is positive.
I have it, right here. Is it Extreme Money? Where is it? I have it here somewhere. Tell us about it. Tell us where to get it.
Oh, it's on Amazon and almost every online site that sells books, and also I think it's in most of the bookstores.
Right, yeah, it's on my desk right over here. As a matter of fact, you sent me several copies to give away, and I was waiting for you to be on the call here. We have to figure out a way to give this away. So what I want you to do is send me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor. Tell me all the reasons that you'd like to hear Das on the show. Seriously. And what we're going
to
do,
Andrew, and there's a second leg to the question.
Oh,
which is the best joke that they can come up about Europe.
About Europe?
Yeah, I think out of it.
That would be good.
So
yeah,
I think we should give it to the best joke.
The best joke. I got you. The best joke
about European economic management.
Clearly, about European economic management. Which is the joke.
And I use the word management very loosely.
Which is the joke to begin with, by the way. But we need something a little bit, you know, more like, you know, who's buried in Merkel's tomb or something. You know, more than that. We need something more than that, you know? But anyway.
Absolutely, and keep it clean, folks.
Yeah.
Keep it clean.
Yeah, relatively clean. So in the end of the day, here's the thing. So we're going to check back with you in a couple months. We've been talking about this. This whole thing has been dragging on a long time. Honestly, I'm at a point. I really am. I'm at a point where it's like, let's move on, but I'm disgusted, sick, frustrated, and tired of the entire process being shrouded in a game of, you know, he said, she said, no, that's not true, yes, that is true, and of convoluted information. I kind of want to get on with, okay, what is the deal? Let's make a decision and move on. Seriously, because it's getting very, very old.
It is, and I think the real issue is the problem's grown. People forget that when the original problem blew up in Greece, the debt was roughly about 100 billion euros less. And every day that goes by and the problem's not dealt with, the problem's going to get bigger.
Yep.
And I just absolutely fear that we're almost at the point where we're going to be singing Carole King, you know, it's too late, baby, now it's too late.
Oh, just makes me well up that song just hearing it from you that way. Listen, Das, I want to thank you for joining us, and we're going to check in with you. Everybody, you make sure to send me in a quick, semi-clean joke about the economy in Europe, something that can make us chuckle, and we have some copies of the hardback, as a matter of fact, the hardcover of Das's book, Extreme Money, coming your way. So listen, thank you for joining us, and thanks for joining us from Down Under. And hopefully one of these days you and I will be able to do a little bit of sitting on the shore down, maybe shark diving or something.
Yeah, well, yep, either in Florida or in Sydney.
Yeah.
Either way would be lovely. It would be lovely to catch up. It's really nice to talk to you again, Andrew.
All right, thanks so much. Have a great day.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And with us right now we have Tom McClellan. You know him. He's a gentleman who crunches numbers and puts out a great number of reports on all sorts of wonderful topics. But famous for the McClellan Oscillator, as well as a variety of other instruments to help you understand what's happening with the markets. Tom, how are you today?
Doing great. Good day. And just to clarify, it was my parents, Sherman and Marion McClellan, who came up with the McClellan Oscillator. I'm just sort of continuing their work and adding a little bit more of my own spin on it.
I don't know about that. I think you put your own spin on it, but you do a fantastic job with it.
Well, thank you.
I don't, because I can't compare what they did. That's the point, right? I haven't seen what their work. All right, a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. The for a long time you've talked about the relationship between lumber and copper and markets. Now, one of the things that I don't know if it broke down or not, but it's acting awfully funny is copper of late. Copper has been just dragged through the mud, and then once somebody starts talking about how it's so low, it pops up really nicely for 3 days, then it comes back down, and I think there's been discussion about or a question: is copper related, or should it be looked at as the leading indicator for markets these days?
It's very closely correlated with the stock market, and the way that we like to look at copper is, when you see the stock market and copper doing the same thing, that's what they're supposed to do. If you see them doing something slightly different, where, for example, the stock market were to make a higher high and copper makes a lower high, that's an important divergence that says there's trouble coming for both of them. And so those are the key indications that we focus in on. And it's not just copper. It's really all commodities. If you put up a chart of the CRB index versus the S&P 500 or the Dow or any index you like, you'll see that they're basically dancing the same dance steps. There's been a much greater correlation among assets lately. For whatever reason, we don't need to worry about what the reason is why that's happening. We just need to acknowledge that it is happening. You can do the same comparison with the 10-year yields. They are doing pretty much the same thing that the stock market is doing. If the stock market's up, then yields will be up. So there's not a distinction among them, and that makes it really hard for somebody who's trying to run a portfolio and be diversified and have non-correlated assets. If everything correlates, it's really hard to diversify.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we ran there's a correlation measure that you could look at. It hit the highest I've ever seen about 3 or 4 days ago, which was kind of interesting. But, you also look at lumber. So, I mean, I think lumber is one of your favorite ones that you've talked about. You talk about as a
well, it
indicator.
Is, mostly because almost nobody watches it. And it's a great economic indicator because lumber sits at the crossroads of a bunch of different economic inputs. You've got timber prices, you've got labor prices, you've got energy prices and transportation costs, all that go into the price of lumber. And so you are seeing a lot of the effects of all those inputs interplaying with each other. And it's, right now it's not good news for the economy that we're seeing lumber prices sinking to multi-month lows. That's not a good piece of news for next year. It tends to be about a one-year lag between whatever lumber does and what happens to the economy and interest rates. So about this time next year, things are not going to be looking good.
Now, you've been pretty bullish on, as you would hear in the media, constructive on equities. And one of the things that you have mentioned is there's some cycle issues, there is some fourth quarter issues, performance chasing possibly. There's a lot of things that have gone into that. You've also seen that the McClellan Oscillator and some summation index are pointing you in the right direction for that have been consistently, for the oscillator, spending some time over the zero line, we'll call it, in a very complex orientation, right? But what's interesting is this bigger backdrop has been this kind of volatile market, right? Where, gains from, 2 weeks can be wiped away in one day, or vice versa for that matter. But I know you're still very bullish overall, at least on the short and middle medium term on the markets, right? On equity markets.
I am. I think we continue trending upward till about late January, early February. And then the game for much of 2012 is going to be how to trade a noisy, violent, sideways trading range. And the way to play that game is you've got to be willing to buy low and sell high and repeat often and not expect that you're going to get a trend that's going to work for weeks or months. It's not going to be what we're going to have for the first half of 2012. Late in 2012, beginning about August, September, October, I do see another big rally coming, but the time for people who want to catch a trending market is right now till about February, and then you need to switch your shoes to trading shoes and not trending shoes.
Yeah, that becomes the hold your nose, and when you feel the worst, the most nauseous and the most absolutely horrible, like this whole game is over, that's when you invest. And when you feel like, wow, things are just great, that's when you sell.
Well, right? And we technical analysts have a lot of great tools for how to follow a trending market, and we have a lot of great tools for how to trade a sideways market and buy over sold and sell over bought. The problem is knowing which tools to use, because if you use the wrong tools, if you try to use the trading range tools in a trending market, you get your lunch handed to you, and vice versa. If you try to catch a trend in a sideways market, you'll just get whipsawed back and forth. So the key is to know what kind of market you're going to have so you know which toolbox to fetch.
Yeah, that's a problem. So what do you do?
Well, you use predictive tools, and you use confirming indications that tell you what kind of market you're in so that you can know how to select which tools you want to use. People that may be familiar with ADX, an indicator developed by Wells Wilder, that tells you about the strength of the trend. When you get to a very high ADX indication, that means you have had a very strong trend, and you're probably not likely to continue having a strong trend. When you have a low ADX, that means the trend has been weak and it's likely to get stronger. And you can use those kinds of tools to tell you when you're likely to have a switch from a sideways to a trending market. But you can also use predictive tools like we use and understanding of what's supposed to happen when to know when to switch.
Yeah, it's been interesting because there's so much other noise. You know, from a technical analysis standpoint, you just can isolate the market, right, from, okay, it has whatever market you're looking at, whether it's the NASDAQ, the Dow, the Russell, the S&P. But you can isolate and say, okay, well, here's the trading range, or here's the particular trend, or here's the moving averages, or whatever you want to use, and just kind of look at that and say, okay, this is what's going on, right? And then there's that other noise that's going on, that whole European debacle and the constant movement of the currencies and all that, that kind of is really a very difficult background setting for a lot of this, isn't it?
I look at that as the wellspring of the fear that fuels an uptrend. You cannot have an uptrend continue without some reason to keep fear alive. If everything was just fine, if all problems were resolved, that would be when the top would come. So you've got to have some reason to be fearful, and Europe is serving it up nicely for us. I still expect the market to trend higher. The big dip that we saw at the beginning of November on the Greece news, that was a little bit of a rogue wave that kind of saw some of the water slosh out of the tub.
Mm-hmm.
But we should get back to trending higher, and we appear to be doing so here on Friday.
Yeah, it's interesting because you have a variety of indications. You know, for example, you know, you look at just the general trend and to kind of smooth it out a little bit. You can't look at the daily, but or the minute by minute, smooth it out. And you look at the overall earnings and you look at the investor sentiment. You know, one of the sentiment indicators that is, I don't know if you could actually quantify this, but there is an absolute lack of, I'll say, long-term fear in this market. I mean, you can get some dips down and all that, but there's just a couple days later, people are right back nibbling.
Well, about a month and a half ago, we had big-time fear. But when we saw the bottom on October 3rd, fear was at a real maximum. And one of the ways that we noticed that and talked about it with our readers is that we look at the asset levels in the RIDEX funds. RIDEX funds are special because that was the first mutual fund family that introduced the idea of leverage funds and inverse funds, and it was real popular for a long time before they started getting competition from ETFs and things. But it's still quite a popular fund family and still useful, and it's still great because they publish the daily levels of the assets in all their funds. And so when you see certain funds getting too popular or not very popular at all, that's a statement about the sentiment of the people who use RIDEX funds. Well, back at the beginning of October, their money market fund saw its assets climb hugely. People
right.
were just saying, get me out of risk. I just want to hide in a zero-yield money market fund so I don't get killed. And when it climbs up to double its recent values, you know that fear is at a maximum, and sure enough, it marked the bottom quite well.
Yeah, the other thing that I like, and I think you wrote about a couple of days ago or recently, and you do it quite often, is the put-call ratio. How incredibly, it's kind of comical, I think, you know, how incredibly I'll say the word wrong it is, but contrarian that it is when you consider when the absolute peak of buying of puts, protection, if you will, compared to the buying of calls, it peaks out and vice versa, is one of those times you say, wow, that's interesting. And boy, people are really nervous. Good thing to be buying puts. But it seems to be that it's always at the wrong time.
That's true. Everybody gets fearful when they buy puts at bottoms. Everybody gets confident when they buy calls at tops. What we have seen over the past about 3 months We used to look at the composite numbers for all of the options traded on the CBOE. That includes equity options on individual stocks and the index options. We used to look at the composite number. That hasn't been working as well. It's been acting kind of funny because there's been some different sort of trading in the last 3 months in the index options. But if you look at just the equity options on the CBOE, that put-call ratio is still working very well. That's the one that we're focusing on. A couple days ago when we saw that big sell-off on Italy debt worries, it got up to a nice high level, which indicates great fear and indicates a bottom for stock prices, and it worked really well.
You know, the whole thing about this Europe thing, which everybody's focusing on, what I find fascinating is that let's say that there is this big fear that, I don't know, Italy, pick your poison, Greece, whatever it is going to have this happen, whatever that is, in a bad way. It's kind of interesting how you see this big blow-off of stocks across the board, and then you start, you know, a day later, somebody says, oh, it's okay, or whatever, and then it gets better. But what I think is funny is that the question of why was the selling going on to begin with, right? So what does, you know, the Greece situation have that is so temporary that people can wash off a couple of days later? Or is it just the natural process of something that happens in the past, it really didn't happen right away, and okay, let's move on?
There's a couple of things going on. There's normal waxing and waning of fear in investors. On November 9th, that was Wednesday, the day of the big drop recently, there was something very specific going on, which was that there's an agency in Europe that is in charge of the trading of European bonds, like Italian bonds. It's called LCH ClearNet. And what they did on Wednesday, the 9th of November, was that they basically raised their margin requirements. They almost doubled them. It's just like when you trade futures on the CME, you have to put up margin with your commodities broker, and you have to maintain those, and the CME group will change the margin requirements like they did when silver got up to 50, and they knocked silver back down by tightening the margin requirements. Well, LCH ClearNet in Europe did the same thing with Italian bonds. They doubled the margin requirements, and that forced a bunch of forced selling. People didn't have the margin needed to meet that higher margin requirement, so they had to sell some of their assets in order to keep their margin at the specified level, and that selling caused prices to fall, which caused other people to have to sell because it reached their price targets, which caused more selling, and that caused more prices to fall, and it just spiraled out of control for about a day and got all done. And then the next day, they didn't raise the margin requirements again, so things could rebound and an equilibrium could be found. So when you have somebody, a quasi-governmental agency like the CME Group or LCH ClearNet or the ECB, putting their thumb on the scale, yeah, you get disruptions. And you don't allow the free market to function. They're thinking that they're helping, and I'm not sure that that's really true.
Well, like actually, let's go the other side as well. CME and ICE last week, they actually changed the margin across all commodities to allow for basically let's put it this way, just to make it easy, they loosened the margin requirements last week.
And part of that was to try to digest the problems of Man Financial or MF Global getting unwound and people having to shop for a new futures brokerage firm because MF Global went out of business. And so they loosened it to put a little bit more lubrication into the system. And they do that all the time at the CME Group. They tighten and loosen and think that they can control things. And it's all volatility-based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So, you know, we talked about all this. So some time ago, you and I talked about the whole presidential cycle, which is kind of wonky this time around, isn't it?
Well, we have just now finished the third year of the Obama presidency, and I measure each of those years beginning on November 1st, because that's when Election Day is, as opposed to January. And so now we're in the election year. The election year, on average, is an up year, but it's much more variable. There have been a lot of election years that have been down years for the stock market. Generally speaking, if you have a down stock market during an election year, the incumbent doesn't win, or the incumbent party doesn't win. So, for example, back in 2000, Bill Clinton wasn't running for re-election because he'd already served two terms, but his vice president, Al Gore, was running, and the stock market was down in 2000. Well, Al Gore didn't win.
Thank God.
But 2004, the stock market was up, and so the incumbent, which was George Bush 43, did win. Well, it's a pretty good correlation.
Too, yeah.
2008 was a big down year for the stock market, and so the incumbent party did not win. In that case, it was McCain running. And so if you want to engineer a victory or a defeat in the presidential election, all you got to do is push the market up or down to make whatever outcome you want to have happen.
And that's you think that's a better indicator than the NFL Super Bowl indicator?
Of course, it's a little bit hard to push the market up or down unless you're the president of the New York Fed,
right,
who wants to become the Treasury Secretary.
Right.
Then you maybe have the power to do that.
Yeah, well, we've seen that. We've seen what we call, I don't know if I told you this, we call Mr. Geithner, he's the kneecapper. Wherever he goes, it seems that somehow something that was very difficult to either agree to or get done, or, you know, he makes a little pass over the place, or, you know, a little visit, and miraculously, you know, he should be involved in the peace talks in the Middle East because he'll get things done. I mean, it's like he'll walk in and it's like, oh, no, not him, whatever. Don't, you know, it's like we call him the kneecapper. He's the guy that
he's not really something that shows up in my indicators. So
maybe
we could talk about something else.
I hear you. Okay, so let's see. What the other thing that I found of interest, you look at, obviously, I think three core issues, right? So you talk about the treasuries, and you talk about gold and metals and all that. Gold has been very kind of interesting also at trading. Tell us about your kind of outlook for gold.
The one fundamental factor that drives gold in the long run is real interest rates. Mm-hmm. And so if you have negative real interest rates like we have right now, where the T-bill yield is below the inflation rate, that is bullish for gold in the long run. Now, there's going to be noise and chop in the meantime, but you have a very bullish factor for gold as long as the Fed chooses not to live up to its mandate to control price inflation.
Right.
And instead of keeping interest rates artificially low and messing the economy up in the process, but that's a different subject. At the point when the Fed decides that it finally needs to start fighting this inflation, which is 4% in the CPI and 7% right now in the PPI, then at that point, it'll be a problem for gold. They haven't shown any indication in their comments that they're anywhere close to that point.
Right.
So for the foreseeable future, things are still bullish for gold. However, having said that, there's an important 13.5-month cycle in gold prices, which is due to have an ordinary bottom on its regular schedule about next February. So between now and February, I'm not as bullish for gold as I will be coming out of that February bottom when you start a new upcycle and you get the most explosive growth prospects. But long-term, gold's still in a bull market.
Yeah, I hear you. Tom McClellan, tell us how to get the information directly from you in terms of McClellan Oscillator, the daily reports, the weekly reports, all the different things that you have to offer.
The best way is to come to our website, which is mcoscillator.com. It's like a McNugget, except it's a McOscillator. And you can see the value of the McClellan Oscillator information index there for free every day. You can sign up for a free weekly email called the Chart and Focus. No strings attached. We won't sell your name on any lists. If you want to get the good stuff, you can sign up for our twice monthly newsletter or our daily edition or both. Those have a subscription cost that's nominal. And we're charging the same price for our twice monthly newsletter that we started out in 1995. So regardless of what the Fed does, we're single-handedly trying to hold the line against inflation.
Yeah, keep that inflation down. I appreciate that. We appreciate that. That's good stuff. Tom McClellan, thanks for joining us today, buddy.
Good to talk to you.
Okay, bye-bye. See, I told you these would be good guys to listen to. Good information right there. So we have, first of all, that little joke contest or that funny contest that we'll have. Send it in to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll make some announcement about the winners coming up. And just listen to Tom McClellan tell us about the current direction and how to read things. And that's kind of interesting. Make sure to see what he's got going on over there. You can get some free samples as well. Until next week, I thank you for joining me today. And I want you to have a very profitable week. And make sure to listen in to DH Unplugged and The Winning Investor, both podcasts that I do. One is on Tuesday and Wednesdays, I guess they come out. Wednesday morning for DH Unplugged with myself and John C. Dvorak. And we talk about all sorts of loopy things. We have a lot of fun talking about politics and markets and business and technology, all sorts of really fun things. And he's a great guy to listen to. And The Winning Investor, quick 5-minute or so tips on how to invest, why to invest, where to invest. You know, the ABCs, 1, 2, 3s. We'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.